get going. And so, as I said, the main focus of this interview is going to be on the period where your work and your efforts interfaced most closely with the Spin Glass work and community. So if you don't, I think we could start with a question about that genesis and about that time. So in your 2018 autobiographical essay entitled Now What, you described the various steps that led to the formulation of what we now know as the Hopfield model. Would you mind walking us through some of those steps, and in particular highlighting the steps that and the stages at which the ideas from Spin Glasses were most important?
Yeah, no, I'd be happy to. I wandered into the area quite by accident. I taught Hodge and Huxley equations as part of teaching biophysics more generally, or biophysical chemistry sometimes. But I never thought of actually trying. I thought of approaching the brain as simply too complex. I didn't see any way of getting a problem in it. And so the details, the biophysics of how neurons worked, and that was it. And then Francis O. Schmidt descended on me one day. I'd just come back very recently from from Copenhagen, where I'd been at the Niels Bohr Institute / Nordita. And the Niels Bohr Institute, Niels Bohr was, of course, himself peripherally interested in biology, and every once in a while he really would organize something biological. And that family has gone back and forth. Of course, Niels Bohr's father was a very famous physiologist. There's a so-called Bohr effect in hemoglobin, which has to do with the pH dependence of the oxygen binding. And that was named for his father. And Bohr had this tenuous interest in the quantum mechanics and how quantum mechanics and biology might relate. And there's that famous lecture of Niels Bohr in 1932 entitled Light and Life, where he was off giving a talk to the people who try to use light physiologically to cure various things. You are photosensitive in various ways. And young Max Delbruck arrived in Copenhagen from Germany one time, just in time to go hear that seminal lecture. And Bohr was trying to describe a parallel between how biology operated and quantum mechanics, and how there might be things in biology which were so sensitive, dependent on quantum mechanics, that biology, through evolution, could actually elucidate some laws of physics which you wouldn't be able to get to by a more sensitive conventional physical means of approach. An interesting idea, I think in the long run, not particularly sound, but very intriguing, and it really moved Delbruck from conventional physics to pursuing biology. Well, as part of that aperiodic, every 10 or 20 years, gearing up and saying, what does physics have to do with biology? I organized a series of seminars at the Bohr Institute in 1977, inviting very good people you'd really call biophysicists or physical biochemists, but people with real quantitative understanding who were working on particular biological problems. I was doing it because they wanted it done, And on the other hand, I was myself looking for a problem. And I didn't find one. Because of course, everybody coming to it, invited to talk at such a thing, doesn't talk about, I'm failing to address the major problems of my enterprise. They try to convince you that they have the major problems all in hand, all well solved. They are great scientists because they've done so. And so I didn't come back to Princeton with any problem. And in that fall, blocking on the name, Francis Schmidt descended on me. Francis Schmidt had been with a pretty strong background in physical science, had become interested in neurobiology. He must have been 75 at the time I first met him, but he was maintaining a really healthy interest in the intellectual enterprise of neurobiology. And in fact, he really brought the term together in understanding that there were psychologists, neuroendocrinologists, neuroanatomists, neurochemists, structural biologists who were like Laurenti Dano, or people who were really looking at the details of the structure of the brain. There were all kinds of separate scientific fields which he felt would somehow have to be gotten together before you would actually understand how the brain worked. My formulation of the issue would really be that in the long run, what the brain does is computation. Computation you have to describe in mathematical terms. And so if you can't describe the brain in mathematical terms, you are never going to understand at heart how it operates. And he dragged me off to one of his little meetings he gave, at which he had these diverse subfields trying to talk to each other. And Schmidt was very good at getting good people to go to his meetings. He was quite skilled at that. And he was posing a challenge to them, a challenge none of them were capable of meeting. I wasn't either. He dragged me off to this meeting because he felt that some representation from physics should help. And I went to the first meeting and looked at the general tenor of it and realized that set of people was never going to solve the problem if you wanted to understand how the brain worked. The basic problem is, if you ask a cardiologist how the heart works, you'll get a good description of a pump and you can understand it. If you ask a neurosurgeon how the brain works, how you recognize your wife, he'll give you a story which has nothing to do with reality. And that's the gap you're trying to fill. And I sort of signed, he asked if I would join this sort of club that he had. And I realized it was an opportunity to get an education. If I joined the club, I might be able to find a problem. That's how my trajectory started, from basically knowing nothing about neurobiology. Now, the year was 1977, and so there was a fair interest in spin glasses in the physics community by then. And I knew some of the cast of characters. I had this earlier incarnation in Bell Labs and semiconductors and so on. I had known Phil Anderson for years and years and years. And I'd always gone to see Phil when I went back as a consultant for Bell. And so I knew the kind of thing that he would be working on. But I didn't know it in any detail at all. But I was in a position where these things could at least get together in one head. And that's where things started.
So would you mind telling us a bit more about as you just said, and you wrote in your essay, Phil Anderson was really influential in you knowing about the existence of spin glasses. So can you tell us a bit more about your relationship with Phil, and how did spin glass sort of emerge in these discussions?
Yeah. I went to Bell Labs basically as a postdoc in 1958, and Phil was at that time still a hidden gem. He'd just written his papers, just published his papers on localization in 1957, and done some papers on gauge invariance and superconductivity, because the original BCS equations were not gauge invariant. And he really viewed himself as the world's most underrated theoretical physicist. But we got along. He taught me the game of Go. And we always had, afterward, when I moved off into semiconductor things, and we kept peripheral contact with the theoretical group. And often when I went as a consultant, I would go look up Phil and spend half an hour with him. The first thing I ever knew about what would now be called a spin glass was as follows. There was a theoretical seminar at Bell in about 1963. You could figure out what the date was by the subject I will tell you about. Now, the theoretical seminar was one of those things at Bell where the whole idea was to try to ask such telling questions of the speaker that you could make it clear that you knew much more about the speaker's subject than the speaker did. And the speaker of that day was A.W. Overhauser, my former thesis professor, and of course a very good theorist, and somebody whom, for some reason, Phil just didn't like. What Overhauser was actually talking on was the very peculiar properties of manganese and copper. And he had a theory of all kinds of how, Overhauser is good at looking at experiments saying, that's an anomaly, we don't know how to explain it. That's another anomaly we don't know how to explain. And put together a set of anomalies and try to create a problem which he could then work on. And he had done a masterful job of that on dilute alloys of manganese and copper. The one which I remember is the fact that copper, of course, has a linear specific heat at low temperatures. If you look at dilute systems of manganese and copper, there's linear specific heat at low temperatures, and the slope of that specific heat is proportional to the manganese concentration. And the area under the curve has something to do with the total amount of manganese. I can't remember any of the details, but it was before I'd ever heard any public discussion of something which later would be understood as a spin glass. Overhauser was, meantime, trying to explain it as spin density waves, and Phil felt that that was just morally wrong. And so it was bloody. But the term spin glass, I didn't hear probably until 1973, I'm guessing. And this was a full decade earlier, when Phil was obviously worrying something about these dilute alloys, and other people were too. They were floundering around trying to understand what the problem was.
I see. So you said by around 1977, that's where you make this connection between, or maybe a couple of years later, between spin glasses and the brain.
I didn't know it, but because I'd heard this early lecture in the 60s, when spin glasses came along, I would always listen to some about them from Phil when I went to see Phil. And because it was Phil, there were interesting visitors who would come and lecture. And I'd also gone, and when Phil was in Cambridge, I'd gone and spent half a year with the with the group which Mott, Phil, and so on were in at the in Cambridge Physics, and at the time met some of the very young crew and some of the older crew who were in England, and so I met Sherrington at the time. I met young Richard Palmer at the time, who came and did a postdoc with me later. But it afforded me the opportunity to learn something about what was going on in spin glasses at a time when spin glasses had actually begun to be honestly developed. However, when I started on neurobiology, I didn't have any idea that spin glasses would have a relevance whatsoever. I was just looking for a problem. And I had to be looking for a problem which was solvable from the point of view of a physicist, because if you had to know all the details of neurobiology, I was never going to get there. And it had to be something which could be mathematized. And if it didn't connect with any other physics, I wasn't probably going to be able to make any progress. The way I made progress was by understanding something about how physics worked and finding peculiar ways of mapping it into biology. So I made up models of multiple neurons interacting with each other and trying to understand something about what kind of states they would have. And the one thing which became obvious in thinking about neurobiology, we were basically thinking about a dynamical system. Equilibrium is not of interest. You're speaking of a strongly driven system and the states of a strongly driven system. And although technically there's much about computation which is reversible, when you build anything other than quantum computers, all computation is done irreversibly. You have two inputs to a logical gate, you take out one output, aha, irreversibility. And so I knew I had to be talking about dynamical systems. And the problem there was simply I knew nothing about dynamical systems. The only dynamical systems I understood at all were those which were statistical mechanical, really, and the dynamics was the way they sought equilibrium. And the other sort of thing lying around was the fact that you know really that what you want to understand, if I ask you how you recognize your wife, you don't want to say, if I simulate 10 to the 11th neurons with 10 to the 14th synapses, this is how it takes place. In the same sense that you don't want to do aerodynamics by saying, let's start with Newton's laws. You derive the Navier-Stokes equation in which molecules have absolutely disappeared, and you start from there. In that same sense, as you try to think about how the brain works and the really interesting questions, they are in some sense higher level. And what you have to do is to see if you can make some progress from the lower levels to some next higher level. The whole idea of emergence was becoming popular, and neurobiology, I would still claim, has more levels of emergence than most systems you've thought about. And so I wound up trying to do simulations of big numbers of neurons, big numbers at the time I was working. 30 was a big number, 100 was a very big number. Computers have gained, roughly speaking, a factor of two in computing power every 2 or 3 years. To appreciate the computer power I was dealing with in 1978, that's 30 decades, 15 powers of two. So if you save what you have now and go back and look at what I was working with, and of course, I don't know whether your roots are quantum chemistry or what your roots are, how you wind up in a chemistry department. What are your roots?
I'm a chemical physicist. My roots are, I worked with David Reichman as a graduate student and with Dan Frenkel in Amsterdam for my postdoc. So I come from the interface between chemistry and physics from the STAT-MEC world. Historically.
But not from the massive chemistry computation side, no. But I made various models. One of the ones which intrigued me greatly for a while was Conway's Game of Life, which you probably know. And the kinds of patterns you could see in the dynamics of the Game of Life when you could run it sufficiently long or sufficiently fast were really quite intriguing. And on the other hand, the rules were very rigid. And if you didn't have exact rules, you really couldn't have anything that didn't just fall apart. And I tried for a while to make a Game of Life, which was sort of like the Game of Life, but with rules which were more like neurobiology. And it did simulations. Couldn't do very good simulations. What it produced was fundamentally junk. And at that time, I made a transition from Princeton physics to Caltech chemistry and biology. And Princeton physics had, by the standards of the day, somewhat mediocre computation facilities, and their chemistry, thanks to the push of people like Bill Goddard, had really first-rate computer facilities. And so when I went to Caltech, I could suddenly do easily simulations of things that I wanted to do for a year. And inside 3 weeks, I found that it was an absolutely useless direction to pursue. And the reason was that the rules you had were very, very much based on simple logical rules. And in terms of many body interactions, the interactions were effectively very short range. And that wasn't going to get me very far in neurobiology, which I knew was intrinsically one neuron talking with on the scale of 1,000 others. Very unlike any real physical system I'd ever seen. On the other hand, you can do statistical mechanics of those. And so I said, let's see what we can do. But if I could only do dynamics that didn't have any statistical mechanics, I wasn't going to get very far because I had no theory of dynamical systems. And so I had to look for a way of getting a dynamical system which is really equilibrium. And then I said, yes, energy functions. And so I could have the statistical mechanics. Maybe I can solve it, maybe I can't, but I have it. And I can therefore talk about doing simulations in which you approach equilibrium and talk about that elementary kind of dynamics as a form of computation. So what's the simplest computation you can do? Which you can describe as a dynamical system going toward equilibrium. And I hit on the idea of memory from partial information. And once I hit on that, things started to fall together, and you want to have more than one memory, of course. And that's what leads you to the, oh yes, I have to have sets of connections which superpose and represent many things. Don't represent anything perfectly. Frustration. And you could say, oh yes, spin glass, there's a good handshake between the two. I never used any of the spin glass mathematics myself, because you needed to be in this peculiar intermediate range, which was intermediate ranges where you have many understandable spin, what you might call almost spin glass states. You don't want to have a spin glass doesn't know anything you put into it. It averages over too much, doesn't know anything in particular. And I had to have a system which knew things in particular. That was the whole idea about your memory. You could pick out particular memories. And that's why I wound up finally doing the mathematics of a system where if you put in a large number of memories, you go to essentially an infinite range spin glass. And you put in one memory, you go to a ferromagnet or anti-ferromagnet or what have you. And in between, you do whatever happens in between. And I didn't try to do any elegant mathematics of the in-between regime. I only did the simulations of the in-between regime, because that's the range in which you could actually see the system computing something from the point of view of accessing, reconstructing a big memory. And the most astounding thing to me was that, having done that and written it down, sent it off to PNAS, you know now. At the time, PNAS was almost solely a biological journal. It had occasional articles on physics, very, very few indeed. But it was in physics libraries, and it was the kind of journal which should promote this kind of interface. And I had the advantage of having just gotten into the academy, really for the work I'd done in biology. But at the time, if you were a member of the academy, you were a member of the academy and could put a short paper in PNAS, essentially with no reviewing process whatsoever. So I said, let me take advantage of that system. And that's how the paper wound up in PNAS. By virtue of the fact that I hadn't actually done any of the interesting mathematics of this intermediate range, after the paper came out, people from spin glasses and statistical physics said, oh, that's something to which I could actually put my talents. And the fact that I had not done all these things, I had not exhausted the field, I'd only opened the lid of the box, made it possible for people to come in. So it wasn't like the set of lectures in Copenhagen where I was saying, I have a total grasp of the field, here's the situation. And that's the trajectory.
Thank you. So picking up on that last point, right? So as you said, you were doing mostly the computations in that regime. This is what sort of gave you the confidence in writing that paper and in publishing it. And many people picked up on those ideas. Did you follow their work after that? Or how much were you aware of, let's say, the efforts of Amit Gottfried and Sampolinski?
I had met Amit in my condensed matter physics days. I'd met Sampolinski because he'd been a frequent visitor to the theoretical group at Bell Labs. I knew who Gutfreund was from Solid State Physics Day. But in fact, I did not know they were working on this, on their paper, until it was published. I just was totally unaware of that effort.
Okay. And following your work, as you said, there's a lot of people in the spin glass community that got interested, including those three. And I'm aware of at least one meeting in 1985 at Les Ouches, where you went as a NATO workshop on disordered systems and biological organization, where there were some people from the spin glass community.
And I would hear them and they would hear me. And yet we had separate enough interests and abilities that I never actually directly worked with these people or tried to understand the mathematics that they were actually dealing with.
So were there many such meetings, or is this 1985 the only one? Or
there were not many such meetings. What there were more meetings in which a quantitative mathematical point of view tried to get together with biology to generate the more detailed mathematics that real neurobiology would bring to the fold. And so the interface with the statistical physics community did not intellectually bear much fruit in neurobiology, except through enabling many people to actually move from physics into computational neurobiology. The set of people who actually came in by reading my paper, Gutfreund, etc., going on in that sense. People like Larry Abbott, for example. And that's what really happened to Amit, for that matter. He went from the original model much more toward biology, because he could see that it would be possible to do the kinds of mathematics of disordered systems, the kind of mathematics that had been done before, except now you really had to be concerned with the fact that you were not really doing equilibrium systems. And of course, at the time, I hadn't even heard the name Lyapunov when I went into this field. And it wasn't until I had written that paper, drafted the paper, and gone off somewhere, and somebody said, "Isn't that a form of Lyapunov function?" I said, "Who's Lyapunov?"
I see.
Because that was, Lyapunov functions were simply not a part of physics education. Hydrodynamics wasn't very often a part of physics education. And so physics was peculiarly quantum mechanics and equilibrium statistical mechanics. People with strongly non-equilibrium statistical mechanics of the Prigogine ilk was viewed as very suspect and quite possibly wrong.
So if you allow me, I'd like to push a bit further in this direction, right? Because following the work of Amit and co-workers, there's actually a number of other papers that revived the perceptron model, right? Which in some ways was antecedent to neural networks and had been left fallow since the late 60s. In particular, the work of Elizabeth Gardner and Bernard Derrida, which explore artificial networks in which the couplings are not given by prescribed rules, such as the Hebb rule. So did you follow this? That is one way in which it was not necessarily leading directly to bridging between physics and biology, but it was more pushing towards the physics interface. Were you aware?
There was some very nice papers showing things about the capacity of a perceptron for random problems. And I remember Elizabeth Gardner's name attached to that. The perceptron is an interesting phenomenon because, of course, a perceptron with one layer of weights has certain capabilities, and they are very, very limited. There are things that you simply can't do. And Marvin Minsky wrote the book The Perceptron, and is chiefly concerned with the one layer of weights perceptron. There's a little bit of hand waving about what happens when you have more layers of weights. And he clearly did not understand how to train a network with a more layer of weights. And he even had the hypothesis that it would turn out to be no more powerful, that the generalization to more layers of weights was sterile. And because he'd done such clever mathematics with one layer of weights, that had a lot of impact. And it was a dead hand on the neural network field for a while. And people who didn't really know about it, on the other hand, pursued this multi-layer analog thing. Minsky was basically stuck on thinking of the computing elements as logical devices. And the real progress got made by saying, let's presume that they are continuous devices. And then you can do continuous mathematics and so on. There again, you can see that the effect of computer power was very important. The multi-layer perceptron was first appropriately described as with a learning rule by differentiation through multiple layers of weights in about 1973 by Werbos, trying to remember. But in 1973, you couldn't do the simulations necessary to demonstrate that it was an interesting phenomenon. By 1980, you could. It was costly, but you could. And of course, by 1985, anybody could do them. But the coming of computer power was really a very essential part of the growth of the whole field and why it started growing when it started growing.
Yes, and thank you. So just to summarize, if I understand correctly, so you know of this work on the perceptron that came out theoretically, but you didn't follow it at the time much. Is that fair to say?
That's right. That's right. Okay. Because the single layer perceptron had been done beautifully and killed by Minsky, and there were some elegant statistical theorems that Minsky did not have about the capacity of it, but it didn't look like a basis for talking about biology.
Fair enough. So talking about computation, so if I understood correctly, in the early 80s, so 1981, 1983, you were teaching a class on the physics of computation at Caltech, right? Yeah. Or co-teaching with Feynman in particular. And I think you were, is it correct to say that you were teaching a module on neural networks in that class, or that's for a later class? I am a bit confused.
Okay. Just get a little bit of Caltech history. Shortly after I got to Caltech, Carver Mead, a computer scientist / electrical engineer. Do you know Carver Mead?
I know his name, yes.
And Feynman got together over supper sometime. Carver liked to be a sort of a buddy to Feynman occasionally. And I think they both enjoyed the interaction. They decided that it would be interesting to try to do a course on involving physics, computation, and covering all possible realms of computation. And one of the things which each of them saw as part of computation was how the brain worked. And so they knew that they wanted to have a course on the physics of computation. It needed to have a strong leg in biology. And biology was a subject, as Tom Lehrer would have said, I knew from nothing. So they needed a biologist as part of this. And so they said, Hopfield's sort of a biologist. Let's make it the three of us. Let's organize this course. And so that's how the course is going to be, the physics of computation. Anything from the physics of how neurobiology works to how neurobiology does computation to the physics of how transistors work and to questions of quantum mechanics and computation, all going to be merged together in one enormous, beautiful course. Marvelous idea. A place like Caltech could get away with trying to do it. And the problem was that Feynman came down with one of his heroic bouts of cancer. And so that course, as it was given, did not have Feynman's participation. He was simply out the entire year. And Carver and I did the best we could. It didn't have Feynman's genius, and it was a real weakness. We tried to make up for it by getting all our friends to come and give lectures. So Carver and I didn't have to do too much of it, and we assumed that the students were brilliant, and therefore you didn't really have to turn out problem sets. You had to expose them to these people giving lectures, and that was chiefly it. The number of people in the class died with an exponential, which is about the same as a year. But some people held on to the end. One of the present Caltech faculty, Marcus Meister. You ever run across Marcus Meister?
No.
He had come to Caltech. He's a German physicist. He had come to Caltech for a one-year just graduate fellowship to be a visitor. Got hooked by Caltech physics and biology, and had a trajectory which took him through that direction ultimately back to Caltech biology, where he does all kinds of very interesting, totally physics-based things in biology. But he's one of the few people I know that actually went to the end of the course. The following year, I ran into Feynman at lunch, and he said, whatever happened to this course that me and you and Mead were going to give? I told him it took place that had been a disaster, and Carver and I had decided that never again. Feynman said, but I would have liked to have done it. Couldn't we do something? Carver was not temptable, but I agreed to participate with Feynman and jointly do this course. But Feynman was actually going to do all the planning for it. So this course then was I can't remember whether it was one or two semesters, but Feynman, every lecture was some topic which Feynman had picked. And he picked a friend or contact who was an expert in the field and would lecture on the topic. The other lecture of the term of the class was chiefly given by Feynman on what the lecturer would have said if he had actually understood his field or how he should have actually described it, and was just brilliant, Feynman. And I learned a lot about that, but it was through this kind of thing that take the subject of error correcting codes. I'd heard about error correcting codes. I knew nothing about them, but Feynman would just get the world's expert on error correcting codes, because JPL was concerned with error correcting codes because of the weak signals coming in from satellites in space. or he would, the first lecturer was Marvin Minsky, talking about Minsky's view of the world, and on. Feynman and Minsky had both been graduate students at Princeton at the same time as I recall. And Feynman talked about his views on the limitations that quantum mechanics would put on computational devices. And Feynman I gave some lectures on my view of neural networks there, but only a couple. Feynman gave his views of quantum computation and a lot of other visitors. And by the next year, things had separated. I was doing a fully sort of neural net course. Feynman was doing really physics and computation. And Carver Mead had gone back to doing the physics of VLSI and large scale VLSI using analog systems.
I see. So by the time it got to be your course, a full semester, a full quarter of neural networks, former students have said that there was actually a significant fraction of the class about spin glasses. So what were you teaching about spin glasses?
What they were, elementary statistical mechanics in particular limits. And the fact that the idea of spin glasses also had ways of programming in the following sense. In the same era, Scott Kirkpatrick was pushing simulated annealing. And when you thought about it, you'd say, gee, if there's an energy function behind the spin glass or a spin glassy system, and you can design that energy function for something you want to minimize, you actually can get the spin glass, the spin structure approach to equilibrium, do the computation for you. And so you could see a quasi-programming language there. And I would teach things about that.
I see. That makes complete sense. So related a bit to that same time, and because you've mentioned Richard Palmer, who's my former colleague at Duke as well, right? And from what I can tell, that you wrote one paper with him, and that it's... That is the only paper you wrote with someone from the spinning glass community, quote unquote. So can you tell me, can you tell us a bit more about the genesis of that paper and the relationships you had maintained with Richard after he'd left?
I'd known Richard in Cambridge and I was reasonably Caltech and had a little bit of money to get people out for visiting. And Richard expressed interest in coming out. And just at the time he was coming out, I'd become interested in unlearning. Because I'd seen many of the I'd seen two large attractors when you started to try to put too much stuff into a neural network. And the way to get rid of two large attractors, from my point of view, was to fall into them because they're too large. And then to modify the exchanged interactions you have to make those states less low-lying. And that would plausibly even out the performance. And all I had was a just-so story at the time when Richard came to visit. And I told Richard the just-so story. He said, seems reasonable. I wonder if it happens that way. And he took over the entire problem of seeing whether it happened that way. And in the same, at the same time, Francis Crick, whom I had known really because of molecular biology, and I had known him in the time when he and I, to some extent, were interested in molecular biology. I'd heard that he had done something on dreams. And what he was doing with dreams was the idea that the function of a dream is not to remember. The function of a dream is to get the brain into a state which it too easily gets into, because it gets into that state in the absence of external inputs, and make modifications so that the state is less favorable. Well, it struck me that the two were just the same thing that Richard and I were working on. And I talked to Francis, and we finally arranged that the that what Richard and I was working on, and the article that Crick was doing. Did he have a co-worker on that? I can't remember. But the article that he was doing on dreams appeared in the same issue of Nature.
Nice.
But that's because Crick had connections at Nature.
But you never kept on. Oh, sorry. What are you going to say?
No. It was the fortunate happenstance of knowing Richard, inviting him out as a visitor, and Francis, and the whole thing just went together beautifully. And Richard is a joy to work with. I always liked him, but we just didn't naturally cross paths very much. He was sufficiently from the statistical physics community. I was sufficiently more neuro/engineering that we just didn't get together and have a research program.
Yes, I can see. But did you stay in touch with him at all, or after this work?
Only casually, and I knew, of course, when he had a stroke. Mm-hmm. But only very casually, and that really sort of put him out of the research community.
No, because with such a high-profile paper, I could have imagined the birth of a long collaboration. So that's why I was curious why it.
I've had such few long collaborations. I've had things which are a few years. There are students that I've kept up with for a long time. But my students / my postdocs, I've always wanted to encourage to have their own problems. And I've never been very good at splitting a problem with people. I did split it for a while with David Tank. I split it for a while with Carlos Brody. The easiest split I ever had was with David Thomas at Bell Labs, because he was fundamentally an experimental chemist. I was fundamentally a theoretical physicist. We could join hands on a problem, and everybody understood who was contributing what. Nevertheless, we could make a much better paper and a much better research approach by talking a lot to each other. And when the two of us were as different as that, it was really very profitable. And I've always found when the two of you are too close together, it's a little bit limiting. It tends to become, I've got the moment better ideas, shouldn't we work on these? And I've never been able to just hand things off to somebody and say, this is your problem, I'll work on it and tell me about it at the end. Because if I'm going to learn anything about a problem, I only learn it by trying to do all the details, trying to do the programming, finding out why the program does not in fact work, and learning from the doing process. And I haven't been able to, for example, have somebody do the elegant statistical physics of something or other and combine it with something which I'm doing.
I understand. I understand.
Only very, very recently, where I have a young former Russian, Dmitry Krotov, whose abilities are so different from mine in theory that, once again, although we're both nominally theorists, I am essentially amathematical when you compare him to him, and therefore there's lots which he does which I never could possibly do. And once again, we have reason for a discussion.
Yes, I see. Thank you. If we go back a bit to the reception to the 1982 PNAS, from what I understand, the response was quite immediate, the enthusiastic, both scientific and institutional response, right? You received the MacArthur Fellowship the following year for that work, essentially. And I hear also that both Caltech and AT&T Bell Labs were organizing Hopfest just the following year, which they kept on. So how did you explain that the response was so immediate and instantaneous to a paper?
Well, I could certainly, I could make plausible neurobiological noises, but I could talk to physicists and electrical engineers in their language without difficulty. And I think it's the communication was a real part of it. And at the same time, there were other intellectual things which were closely related. Backprop, for example, was closely related. And the Boltzmann machine was closely related. One of the things that the 1982 paper failed to do was to have an interesting learning algorithm. You could instruct to learn memory. That instruction step was very like Hebbian synapses from biology. But it was instructing to remember this particular thing or that particular thing, the idea of incremental changes, being able to express something which the Boltzmann machine brought and which Backprop brought was absent in what I'd done. What the Boltzmann machine did involving temperature was trivial. It was in an early draft of the paper which I wrote for PNAS, and except it was too long and got taken out and thrown away. But the fact that there was, when you looked at it, a learning rule, an incremental learning rule for the Boltzmann machine, was a real intellectual breakthrough. And that brought a whole learning community in from the side, who were then exposed to the fact that there was a statistical mechanics behind these things. And the community only learned about statistical mechanics through physics. In fact, the original Boltzmann machine paper by Hinton, Sinowski, and Ackley. Ackley was, I believe, a graduate student who I'm sure did the gut work, but not the intellectual contribution. But Terry Sinowski actually had to teach Hinton what statistical mechanics was. But Hinton had the idea for how to learn. And so they were very complimentary for a while.
I see. So the world was ripe, in a sense, for that work. That's your main...
The world was ripe, that's right. And it didn't hurt that world that... Terry Sinowski was an interesting case. Terry Sinowski was a Do you know him?
No, I don't.
Do you know of him in any sense?
I wish I could say so. I will know shortly after our interview, but I don't know at this moment.
But he was the co-discoverer of, or creator of, the Boltzmann machine and Boltzmann machine learning. And that's a very important force on getting statistical physics and learning together. He started off as a graduate student of general relativist John Wheeler. And then there was a falling out, and I ran into Terry. He was auditing a course I was giving in physical biochemistry at Princeton. It shows you how far the biochemistry department at Princeton had fallen, that me, who had never had a chemistry course beyond what have you, was teaching physical biochemistry. But at any rate, Terry was auditing, and he got to talking with me after class. He described to me a couple papers which he'd written and gotten published while he was a dropout. And these are papers at the interface between physics and they were simple, very simple neural computation things. Not very important in hindsight, but he was doing them on his own. I said, you need a thesis to get out of here. You package these papers up with an introduction and a conclusion. I will attest to it as a physics thesis. And so he wound up being a student of mine, and I've always been close to him ever since. But having somebody like that with very good physical understanding and knowledge of what physics could do, and who'd actually then on his own learn some neurobiology, he was somebody who also helped bring not spinning glasses, but statistical physics into the whole area.
I
can't think of a real impact that spin glasses as such had, other than through the people and through the attitudes which came with it. And of course, part of it is just the physicist's confidence. I know more than anybody else, and I'm smarter than anybody else. And
it's part of the trading, right?
Yes.
So before we close, is there anything else you would like to share with us about that area, about that era, sorry, that we missed, that we should, you think we should be exploring?
It's interesting. It's just, it's mostly just the avenue that that you've got to do the non-equilibrium statistical many bodies statistical mechanics, and it's got to have some order and some quasi randomness to large-scale interactions, and you've got to be interested in collective properties. And the only place you can name that where that's understood is spin glassy kinds of things. And so if you look to trying to understand the psychology, you're going to have to fight your way through several layers of emergence. And emergence is a subject which was not much discussed in 1970. And in thinking about what you're writing on spin glasses, in some sense, emergent behaviors of large and collective systems became developed as a subject in that period. And that's a slightly different community, but one which is important at least to look at. And I think it has people from the spin glass field probably heavily in it.
It's a good point and a good idea. I want to give the chance to my colleague and collaborator, Francesco, in case he has questions that I might have missed, I would appreciate.
Maybe just to summarize, I think it would be useful to have your opinion, let's say, on the extent to which Spinglass ideas have influenced the development of neural networks and vice versa. It seems to me that during the interview you said that most of the mathematics of Spinglass influential for the developments in neural networks. Did I understand correctly? And do you think, for example, I don't know, maybe in RT, can you hear me? Because it seems that my connection is not very stable.
Your connection is not very stable, so make an effort to speak slowly and clearly. I can hear you, but the connection is just a little flaky.
Patrick, you want to rephrase my question? Maybe it's going to be clear, because here I have my internet is not very reliable.
The core of the question I understood was that is, you know, what's your impression, general impression of the cross influence between Spinglass and neural networks in their development? But I missed the second point as well. So that's what I.
No, yes, I had the impression during our discussion that you had the feeling that in the end, most of the mathematics that has been developed in the Spinglass field was not so influential in the end for the development of neuroscience or neural networks. Did I understand correctly?
I think that is my view. And part of that is, look, there's the beauty in mathematics you can do in the large N limit. Biology does not operate in the large N limit. It operates, on the other end, the intuitions you can get in the large N limit are considerable. And it's important to understand that as a source of intuitions about what might happen for finite N. But being able to do the mathematics of infinite N is not a very direct relevance.
Yes. Okay.
Thank you. And the last question I have is more of a technical one. So I presume you still have notes, papers, correspondence from those times. Do you intend to deposit them in some university archives, or has it already been done?
I don't have as much as you might hope. One thing there is in existence is a pretty good set of notes on the lectures which took place in some of the physics of computation courses at Caltech. And a person that I would ask about that is Marcus Meister, Marcus Meister, professor of probably biology at Caltech, but he's the guy who was a physics graduate student at the time of the first lectures there. And the other person that you could inquire of in this direction is Pietro Perona, Pietro Perona, who is faculty at Caltech, probably in engineering, and last thing I knew was head of the computation and neural systems effort at Caltech. But he's been around a long time and would be the other source. My notes are astonishingly bad. I'll have notes on the few lectures that I used to give notes on the courses I gave, but the physics of computation things, I will listen and learn much more than written my own notes on.
And did your correspondence just disappear when you moved back to Princeton, or?
Correspondence tended to disappear, and of course there's the transition from paper to computer, then from computer A to computer B to computer C, with conflicting ways of storage. And so an awful lot of this transition period is just lost.
Okay, I understand. It's unfortunate, but I understand. I've seen part of it happen myself, so. Thank you so much for your time and for your engagement. It's been really a genuine pleasure to get to exchange with you and to hear more about your viewpoint and that very special time, I think, in the history of modern physics. So.
Well, I'm always thank you very much for. I hope you found something useful in it, and thank you for pursuing it and trying to get it into an archive.
Absolutely. Francesco, did you want to say?
Thank you very much for pointing out this paper on dreams. It looks very interesting, and I will read it because I was thinking about that related things recently, so I'm very curious to read in more details what you did on. And the relation with the other papers. So thank you.